When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. Have you ever used it before, producer Naya?
I have, but I was one of the quality professionals that you mentioned looking for the perfect role. And guess what? I found one.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. What job was it?
It was this very job, and I got it by using LinkedIn Jobs. So if it wasn't for the platform, I wouldn't be sat here speaking with you, Giles. Now imagine that.
Oh, wow, that is truly amazing. Well, we've got a lot to thank them for. And it proves that LinkedIn isn't just a job board. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place.
And on LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Hire professionals like a professional on LinkedIn.
Post your job for free at linkedin.com/purple. That's linkedin.com/purple to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Something Rhymes with Purple with me, Susie Dent, and my co-host, Giles Brandreth. And we get together every week, really, don't we, Giles? Just to, well, to say hello, because I haven't actually seen you in person for quite a while now. I will now in our live shows coming up quite soon. But also just to discuss our absolute favourite subject, which, of course, is words and language with our fantastic followers, the Purple People.
But you're in my head all the time. You may not be.
Is that a bad thing?
No, it's a good thing. Well, I've got into the habit of waking up at about 4 in the morning. Mm. It's so annoying. Between 4 and 5 in the morning, I wake up and I'm awake for about an hour. And I've decided instead of lying there worrying, I'm going to think about you. So I have a kind of conversation with you. And last night I came up with this riddle, which I thought I would try out on you. This is, I say last night, early this
riddles.
Morning. And this is the question. This is for you, Susie Dent. What were three nouns, two verbs, and an adjective doing in court?
Three nouns. Are the numbers relevant?
No. What were three nouns, two verbs, and an adjective doing in court? This is what I'm thinking about at 2 in the morning. I'm thinking, how can I amuse
Susie?
Discussing
their sentence?
This. They're waiting to be sentenced. Yes. Well done. And I'll give you, I lay there. I've got two more. And then we can move on to what we're supposed to talk about. What is small, red, and whispers because it's got a sore throat? I lay there in bed thinking, oh, God, I'm going to ask this to Susie later. What's small, red, and whispers because it's got a sore throat?
I was thinking tonsils. I don't know.
A horse radish.
Oh,
yay.
I like that one.
Because it's a radish, it's small and red, and it's also it's whispering. And the last one, this is relevant to what we're going to chat about today, and that's why I think I thought of it. What do you call a cat caught in the chemists?
Cat caught in the chemists.
This will only work for people who know a big chain of chemists' shops.
Oh, Puss in Boots.
Boom.
Very good.
So that's what I do. I lie in bed tossing and turning and thinking, well, I'll try and think of some silly riddles to give to Susie. Do you ever have sleepless nights?
Yes, I do. I can't remember a night, really, when I haven't woken up several times, but I am quite lucky. I do tend to go straight back to sleep. So I'm hoping that I'm just coming out of a sleep cycle and then going back in. But what you suffer from, do you remember the word from Old English, which is uchtkearu?
Oh, no, I don't. How do you spell that? I can write that down.
U-H-T, as in milk. Yep. And then C-E-A-R-U.
C-E-A-R-U.
And it's essentially the sorrow before dawn.
Utkaru. It is. Well, it's not so much sorrow as it is anxiety, though.
Yes.
It's anxiety before dawn.
Yes, it's care.
And happily, though, we do allow our cat, Nala, to share the bedroom with us.
Oh, do you? No wonder you don't sleep.
Well, She is very, very good. She's got a chair that she sleeps on.
Ah, okay.
Normally, but she does sometimes jump up onto the bed. But I find her quite soothing and quite companionable.
She doesn't sit on your head like my cat.
She does. She sits on my wife's head. What is interesting, she is my wife's cat.
Okay.
Or she's the neighbor's cat, as you know. But she's linked to my wife, and she does sit. And I think it's because my wife says this is just cupboard love. She's just wanting a sort of midnight feast.
It's very true. But why do they sit on a head? I don't really understand this. So either that or you feel like you're having, you know, the word nightmare goes back to not a horse that's a mare, but the sort of evil spirit called a mare that was said to come and sit on your chest and almost make you feel like you were suffocating. That was the nightmare. And that's how Bo, my cat, makes me feel if she sits on my chest. It's like I wake up and I can't breathe.
Your cat is called Bo, not as in Bo Brummel, B-E-A-U,
no.
But as in Bo Peep.
She's a she. And yes, we didn't give her the name Bo Peep. And it seemed quite sweet because my kids were a lot younger when we got her from Battersea. Battersea is a cat and dog rescue centre, which has been going for many, many years. Brilliant. In London, they have lots of stations elsewhere in Britain as well. And we got her from there when she was a tiny kitten. And they called her Bo Peep because she was the scaredy cat, the real scaredy cat. So she was just very, very shy and would peep out from under a chair to see whether it was safe to come out. So they called her Bo Peep. So we've kept her. We don't ever call her Peep. We just call her Bo.
I wonder what the origin of Bo Peep is. I mean, it's a nursery rhyme character, isn't it?
It is, yes. Bo Peep. I don't quite know why she was called Bo, though. Little Bo Peep was lost to sheep.
Maybe it's to do with Boo, saying Boo.
Yes, maybe.
Boo. Does your cat have a breed?
She's a Moggy.
Oh.
She's an absolute Moggy and a small, I think they just said, small domestic breed. She's got the most beautiful eyes, I have to say. I would love to have Bo's eyes. They're just absolutely gorgeous. And we'll get on to the etymology of Moggy later, actually. But I should just say that it's very interesting. When you look at dog breeds, there's always a story to them. So we've talked about them before, that the poodle goes back to the German Pudelhund, a splash hound because they love water, a terrier loves digging up the earth, and it goes back to terra, meaning earth in Latin, and terre in French. So quite often, dog breeds have really lovely etymology. Cats, not so much, unfortunately. They tend to be named mostly after places. They're the Bengal, the Abyssinian, the Persian, the Siamese, etc. So we thought we wouldn't focus on those today because most of them are, as I say, fairly self-explanatory.
Though, I have to tell you, I'm sorry we're not focusing on them because I've done a lot of research.
Oh,
and No, what I'll share with you, and maybe we'll come back to this another day, is I have a son-in-law who is a vet.
Oh, yes.
And I said to him, what are the most popular breeds of cat in the UK? And he said he reckoned the most popular breeds in the UK are probably first the British Shorthair, then the Bengal, believe it or not, then the Siamese, and then in fourth place, the Maine Coon, which is what our cat, Nara, is a Maine Coon.
Ah, okay.
Then Persian, then a kind of breed that I hadn't really heard of called a Ragdoll.
Yes, Ragdoll. Rachel Riley used to have a Ragdoll one as well. The Ragdolls, I think, were so named because they're incredibly docile. So they have an unusually docile temperament, as though they are just a doll that just sort of hangs there in your arms. So I think that's where it comes from originally. So not recorded until 1970, the Ragdoll.
Well, take us into the world of cats. Where are we going to begin? Where do you want to begin?
Well, we could start with the word cat itself, if you like.
Please.
Because you will find catus, C-A-T-T-U-S, in Latin and in some Roman texts. But it's generally thought to be an Egyptian word because it's in Egypt that cats were first domesticated. But it's a little bit like dog. We've got a slightly clearer view of its journey. But if you remember dog, and we often mention this, one of the most mysterious etymologies given its everyday use in English, we just don't know where dog came from. And it's not too dissimilar for cat, because what the Romans normally called a cat was feles, F-E-L-E-S. And that meant she who bears young.
Oh, I thought it meant faithful or happy. No, Felix.
But that's Fides. Or Fides. Ah. And Felix is happy and Fides is faithful. Yes.
So that's why dogs are called Fido, as in faithful.
Yes.
And cats are called Felix or have been,
happy.
As in happy. But that doesn't relate to feline.
No. So the feline, as I say, does go back to Latin, and feline doesn't appear in English until the late 17th century. And most modern European languages have words that are linked to the philes, that Roman word. And it's interesting, I was reading this in the dictionary actually, that feline is generally linked with positive words, isn't it? She has feline eyes, for example, or feline grace. Whereas catty is something you definitely don't want to be. That is just spiteful, resentful, and, you know, not nice at all. So it's interesting that they've gone in two different ways when it comes to context.
Well, I suppose the origin of catty is because certain cats, when they're fighting, fight in a quite unpleasant way.
Oh, that's gosh, and the noise.
The screeching. How long has the word catty been around? Would Jane Austen have known the word catty?
19th century.
Oh, so she might have known.
Yes, possibly. And then, I mean, cat features in so many colourful English expressions, so we can talk about those. But I did say I would mention the etymology of moggy.
Please.
And moggy being a non-pedigree cat. So Bo is, as I say, short hair moggy. And it's simply a variety of Maggie, which in turn, of course, goes back to Margaret. Now, if you remember, we have always loved choosing people's names, particularly when it comes to animals and birds, Robin Redbreast, for example. And if you remember, the magpie was also named after Margaret. It was Maggoty Pie originally, nothing to do with maggots and everything to do with Mago, which was another nickname for Margaret. So we simply attached that to Mog and Moggy. It's nothing to do with Mongrel, which is a non-pedigree dog. Because that's based on Mingles. It's a sibling of Mingles, but of course, a mongrel is a mixed breed.
Mm. Very good. I think we've touched on this before. Pussy. Mm. As in puss, 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 pussycat. Why is a cat a pussy?
Well, it's probably imitating the hissing sound. So if you're trying to get a cat's attention, you might go ps, 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 or the noise of the cat hissing itself might sound a bit like ps, 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 ps. So it's a similar sound that you will find in the sort of nickname for a cat in so many different languages across the world. It's quite interesting, that sort of replication of the ps. But it was also used as a term of endearment for a girl or a woman, and then childishly to anything soft and furry, which obviously is where the slang sense crept in. And to play pussy in World War II RAF slang was to take advantage of cloud cover. So to jump from cloud to cloud, either to chase an enemy aircraft or to avoid being recognised yourself. So, yeah, that's the sort of the pussy thing. As I say, term of endearment. But as so many terms of endearment have been, they are often applied to female genitals.
Yes. There's a terrible joke, which I don't think I dare tell you, but it involves somebody who is making his last wish. This is a really dreadful joke. Anyway, no, I won't even tell you. I'll just give you the payoff line.
Oh.
He's been captured and he's been strung up and he's been told he can have one last wish. And this beautiful creature turns up and he says, no, you said the wrong thing. I said posse. Anyway, that's by the by. He was looking for a rescue posse and not for
what the other thing. Anyway. Just while we're on the pudenda, I should just say that there is one rival theory which goes, you know, it's either the soft and furry thing, but it could also be from an old Norse word. Some linguists think puss meaning a pocket or a pouch. And if you remember, while we're on this subject, vagina goes back to a word meaning a sheath, again, or a pocket. And it's actually linked to a vanilla because vanilla has a pod. So vanilla and vagina are rather strange kissing cousins. I'm not sure kissing cousins is the right word for it. But
this is fantastic. Here we are stroking our pussies and we suddenly find ourselves with vanilla ice cream in our pods. Oh, it's
exactly.
Too silly for words, isn't it?
We have. What about a tomcat?
Why is a tomcat called a tomcat, not a billcat or a bincat?
Who knows? I mean, Tom famously used a bit like Jack. I mean, I think Jack is probably the most frequently used name when it comes to identifying objects in English. Tom, probably somewhere on the list, high up. Just a generic name from the 18th century, but there was in 1760 an anonymous work called The Life and Adventures of a Cat. And the hero was a male cat that was called Tom and was commonly called in the story Tom the Cat. So it may have been popularised by that.
Meow. I know how to spell it. I think M-E-O-W, that's the noise traditionally made by a cat. You'll find writers saying the cat meowed. Did they actually ever make that noise? Who invented that word? How long has it been in print, meow as a word?
That's a really good question, actually, because I don't have the first date, so I'm going to look it up now. I do know that It's almost the same in every different language. Meow in French, M-I-A-O-U, and then it's M-I-A-O, I think, in German. And then in Japanese, it's nyan, which is quite similar. I think nyan is possibly a bit closer to meow. 1632, according to the OED, to make a characteristic cry of a cat. And they do have in French as well, at least they did have miaule, M-I-A-U-L-E-R, which was to meow. Yeah, I think it's quite a good approximation of the sound, but it will never be exact, will it? I mean, do you think cows really go, I mean, they go, but I'm not sure they go, moo.
Meow. Maybe we should have a party in 2032. I mean, next year we're going to be celebrating the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's First Folio.
Yes.
Maybe you and I should organise a great cat gathering, the biggest meow in the history of the world, for the 400th anniversary of the word meow. Get millions, get millions of cats.
You couldn't get cats together because they just don't like each other, do they? I was having this conversation about hamster with my youngest because she wanted to get another hamster, and hamsters famously just kill each other to fight to the death. So I don't know if it would be very similar with cats. I'm not sure you'd want them all in the same room, not least because they would give out lots of caterwauling, which is a horrible sound. And it's reminded me actually of a great word in German for a hangover, which is a Katzenjammer, which again is a kind of caterwauling, because the sounds in your head when you've got a hangover just are like the din of cats collectively clamouring at each other.
You know what we used to do with our children when the hamsters died? Because we had hamsters as well, and they were always dying and fighting with each other, exactly as you said.
Yeah.
We eventually put them in the blender, in the Moulinex, and spread the residue on the flower beds with the most fantastic results. You won't believe it. You probably heard, you may wonder why, but you will have heard the song. There's a song about it, because you get tulips from hamster jam.
I knew this was going somewhere. I hoped it was going somewhere funny, because I just thought, how could you ever use your blender again?
And it wasn't going anywhere funny. It was going somewhere
tulips
awful.
Tulips from hamster jam.
A dreadful, dreadful pun. Anyway, you mentioned my idea of getting millions of cats together. People use the phrase like herding cats. Cats have come into lots of phrases in the language. I assume like herding cats is simply because it's so difficult to herd a cat.
Yes, absolutely. And there's a very popular belief that this began with a script from The Life of Brian, the wonderful Monty Python film. And it does seem like it was used there. And if you look in the Oxford English Dictionary, it will give you 1986 for its first record of trying to herd, or be like trying to herd cats, in other words, an impossible task. And The Life of Brian was the 1970s, wasn't it? 1976. Yeah. So it's very possible that it did popularise or even give us that phrase, like herding cats. But yes, it's an impossibility. So I think definitely we will not be having a meow fest. Not sure I'm going for that one, Giles. But there's so many expressions, aren't there?
Cat got your tongue?
Yes, cat got your tongue. Now, there was... Well, I mentioned ancient Egypt, and in ancient Egypt, cats were considered to be very, very sacred. So one of the ideas was if the cat got your tongue, it literally, your tongue would be kind of taken out if you had sort of transgressed either against a cat or against society. And so you would, you basically have your tongue whipped out, which I think was quite a common punishment. But I think the dates in English, I'm just checking this in the OED, 1911. I was so angry at her that I made no answer. This is from a novel. Presently, she said, has a cat got your tongue? It says here, in many colloquial and proverbial expressions of obvious meaning, but it's not at all obvious, I think, where that one comes from. No. So who knows? May go back to ancient Egyptian mythology, may simply be to do with a cat of nine tails, which certainly is behind the no room to swing a cat. Now, the cat of nine tails was a really, if you remember, pernicious instrument of torture aboard ships, and sailors who had broken the rules would often have what would be beaten and flogged using the cat of nine tails.
And why is it called a cat of nine tails?
I think because it had lots of sort of lashes that were attached to it, probably nine of them, I'm guessing, that when you swung them around, particularly if they had sort of horrible studs attached to them, they could really perform something nice.
But why is it called a cat?
Here we go. Probably the name was one of grim humour in reference to its scratching the back. Ooh. Okay, so it's about
like
claws.
The marks, like cats' scratch
claws.
Marks.
Yeah, ooh, it's a bit grim, isn't it?
It's very grim. And how does that relate to swinging No Room to Swing a Cat.
Well, No Room to Swing a Cat is you literally, this is a whip with 9 knotted lashes. You'd need quite a good swing room for that.
Oh, so it's not actually picking up your cat by the tail and swinging it around.
Well, there are theories that that is behind it as well, because we won't go into detail here because it really is too distressing, but they used to do absolutely awful things with animals for entertainment. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility.
Oh, dear. And letting the cat out of the bag, is that something horrific as well?
Yes. Now, we have done this one before, I think, when we talked about buying a pig in a poke. And we also talked about letting the cat out of the bag. So buying a pig in a poke was the scam, if you remember, where you thought you were buying a little piglet, which you could then grow for pork, breed for pork. And it would be in a poke, which is an old name for a pocket or a bag. And the idea is that you pay your money, you get home, you open the poke or the pocket, and out pops a cat, which was not considered to be valuable at all. So you let the cat out of the bag and the secret is out.
Very good.
Yeah.
Any more? A Cat in a Hot Tin Roof? I mean, that's the title of a play, I know. Is that the origin of the phrase? No.
No.
The play was named after the phrase.
Yes. I think it's just
to be
really...
It's a Tennessee Williams play, yeah.
Yeah, to be really agitated. So obviously, if you imagine a cat in a hot tin roof, it's going to be lifting its paws up and down because it's too hot to stand. So that's the idea, is you're just unable to keep still. You're like a cat on a hot tin roof, or on hot bricks is the other version, isn't it? And then you've got More Than One Way to Skin a Cat, which again sounds really grim. Happily, I'm not sure this is to do with literally skinning cats, because the OED thinks it begins in the 17th century with a completely different phrase, which is to skin a flint. Now, to skin a flint was all about greed, essentially. So a flint is a piece of hard stone used to make sparks, and there is no skin, of course. And so the idea is that if you're even trying to whittle away at that, then you are very, very mean indeed, because you're not prepared to spend any money.
As a skin flint.
Like a skin flint. Exactly. That's where we get that from. And apparently, to skin a flint was one of many phrases about skinning things that were all about either stinginess or the willingness to go to extreme lengths. So there were lots of them, I think, and definitely not just cats. I'm just trying to think if I can give you skin a louse, skin a flea, and finally to skin a cat. But it underwent a bit of a change there as well, because it was, you'd say, oh, he's someone who would skin a cat, again, meaning that he's very greedy, not greedy, but very stingy. But then it sort of changed to the expression that we know today. There is more than one way to skin a cat, meaning there's more than one way of achieving your aim.
Why do cats have 9 lives?
Well, I mentioned that cats being worshipped in ancient Egypt, they were highly revered, they were praised for being magical. And that's probably why they were thought to have 9 lives, because they had some sort of special supernatural power that enabled them to evade danger. And lots of different traditions really revolving around cats. So farmers would often leave offerings for cats to ensure a good harvest. The Chinese apparently still believe, we might have some purple people in China or who are Chinese, that believe cats protect their crops, presumably from being eaten by rats and mice. But again, they're good omens. We talk about a black cat crossing our path as being very lucky. So lots and lots of different associations with luck and with charm. And so, you know, perhaps they did have magical powers that would enable them to escape more often than other animals. And then you have to also remember that the number 9, particularly in Greek mythology, has also got magical significance. It starts with the 9 muses, the goddesses in Greek mythology who, you know, inspired musicians and dancers and authors. So 9, a special number, certainly, in mythology and tradition.
One of my favourite poems about cats is Gus the Theatre Cat by T.S. Eliot.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of his collection in Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats. And a film was made of the famous Andrew Lloyd Webber musical, Cats.
Yeah.
That was deemed to be very unsuccessful and people mocked the film. I went and saw it and I really enjoyed it. And in the film, Sir Ian McKellen performs Gus the Theatre Cat. And it is 10 minutes of bravura theatricality. I just recommend people, you don't need to enjoy the rest of the film, just go to see Ian McKellen being Gus the Theatre Cat.
Oh, and it's got your friend Judy Dench in it as well, hasn't it? I have to say, I've not seen it.
Well, a lot of people haven't seen it. She, Judy Dench, indeed hasn't seen it. And I said to her, you should go to see this film. A, you're amusing in it, and B, your friend Ian McKellen is brilliant in it. But she said she doesn't like going to see the films that she is in.
Oh, I totally.
She feels awkward looking at herself. And also she says it's so frustrating because you think, oh, I could have done that differently. I could have done that better. She prefers being on stage where she knows, well, there will be another night. I can perhaps do it better tomorrow.
Yeah.
Whereas on film, it's there. Speaking of being on stage, because I was, my last stage partner was indeed Dame Judi Dench. I was at the Gielgud Theatre this summer with the great Dame Judi Dench, and I may be back with her in the theatre again.
Aww.
But having warmed up with Judi Dench, I'm now sharing the stage with none other than Susie Dent.
I know, I can't wait for this.
When is this? It's quite soon, isn't it? End of September we're starting again.
End of September. And we're taking Something Rhymes with Purple back on stage. So we will be recording a podcast. Each show will be very different. There will be extra bits, so not just the podcast. And we'd love to meet as many purple people as possible, because we always say this, don't we, Charles, that you and I have been really touched, actually, by the reception of the podcast and how much people, particularly during the pandemic, sort of turned to it and many other podcasts, I'm sure, as well, just for some escape, really, and some calm.
We're not exaggerating. I have to say, every time we've been very moved in the wings, chatting to each other. And then we meet people either in the interval or after the show or before the show. So it's a chance to say hello to purple people in person. And we're doing a whole series in London at the Fortune Theatre, which is a beautiful little theatre in the heart of Covent Garden, just opposite the Theatre Royal Covent Garden. And I will find it very difficult to resist telling some of my theatre stories there. And when we're in Oxford, at the Oxford Playhouse on the 9th of October, I will find it impossible not to tell some of my stories about the great Sir John Gielgud and Ronnie Barker and a whole host of other people that I first met at the Oxford Playhouse.
I was thinking of Ronnie Barker just last night, because I was at a recording of the Comedy Countdown version, 8 out of 10 Cats Just Countdown, eating some really delicious food that was made by a canteen, a mobile canteen called Four Candles, which, of course, comes from a very, very famous Two Ronnie sketch. And it just made me laugh. Yeah. Oh, I can't wait to hear those stories.
Good. Well, if people want tickets, they can just go to somethingrhymeswithpurple, all one word, .com. Somethingrhymeswithpurple.com, and you can get tickets for those shows. And we want to see you there. Should we take a quick break?
Let's take a break and then we'll get back to correspondence.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
You may have heard of the podcast Juicy Scoop. Wondered what it is? Why aren't you listening? Well, I'm its host, created it, been doing it for 7 years. I'm Heather McDonald of Juicy Scoop with Heather McDonald. Now, I could tell you why you should be listening to my show, but my listeners wanted to write the ad for me, and here are some of the things they said. Not your regular Juicy podcast. Catch up on all the juicy topics from Hollywood and pop culture to true crime and beyond. Heather McDonald's Juicy Scoop always has great guests, great laughs, and great gossip. It's a comedian's take on the hottest headlines. Juicy Scoop is the pop culture news you want to hear. No BS, no filter, no filler. Raw, real, and in the moment. Throw in the hilarity of amazing comedians that you will instantly be obsessed with, a juicy crime story, and a dash of normal life in LA moments, and you've got yourself an amazing week of Juicy Scoop. Two episodes every week, every Tuesday and Thursday. It will never let you down.
Who's been in touch this week, Susie?
Well, our first email, and I have to say it's one of many for which, we are really, again, very appreciative. And we do read all of them, even if we can't quite get to all of them on the podcast. But this is from Daniel Sturman.
Dear Susie and Giles, a recent U.S. Supreme Court opinion used the term mare's nest to refer to something undesirably tangled or complicated. A legal podcast that I listened to was fascinated by that phrase and took a side journey to discuss its origins. Since I know that one of the hosts of that podcast listens to your podcast, I think she would be tickled pink to hear from an expert in the field. What is the history of the term mare's nest, and how has it changed over the years? Thanks for a wonderful podcast. Daniel Sturman, Jerusalem, Israel.
Thank you, Daniel. Mare's nest. I know the phrase, and I know, I think, what it means. Something very complicated, full of, fraught with complexity. But I've no idea what the origin is.
Yes. So that's how we tend to use it these days, for a confused mess or a muddle or a misconception. But actually, it started off meaning something very, very different. Because if you espied a mare's nest in the 16th century, you imagined that you'd discovered something really wonderful, but in fact, it didn't exist. So it was a kind of an illusion, but especially one that you boasted about and then looked very foolish because of it. So obviously, horses can't produce nests. And there was an earlier version to horse nest, meaning exactly the same thing, something that is too good to be true and you look a bit foolish for believing in it. And it wasn't until almost three centuries later that it came to mean, because a nest, I suppose, we associate with things that are just sort of full of miscellaneous bits and bobs, we came to confuse it with a muddle, or associate it with a muddle or a confused mess.
Yeah. Lucy Dakin has been in touch.
Dear Susie and Giles, I have recently discovered your podcast and have rapidly become somewhat addicted. A Brit who lives in Brisbane, Australia, I listen mostly whilst walking our dog. I have a question about the word cute. My 12-year-old daughter uses this word very frequently, mostly when talking about our dog, and I wondered about the origin. I noticed the word used in the novel Mill on the Floss, written as cute, with an apostrophe. I wondered if it was related to the word acute. Best wishes, Lucy Dakin.
How interesting.
Well, the answer is yes, it is. Oh. She's absolutely right. And it's not, really, this is not a couple that you would put together. And it's a sort of process that's called aphesis, A-P-H-E-S-I-S, which is the kind of gradual unintentional loss of a short vowel at the beginning of a word. So if you think of squire for esquire, for example, that's an example of aphesis. And so it is with cute and acute. But the first meaning of cute was acute, to be clever, to be keen-witted and sharp, to have a cute mind, if you like. That was in the 18th century. And then a century later, particularly in schoolboy slang, it was used of things that were attractive or pretty or charming, because, of course, quick-wittedness is a positive attribute. And you can see the same journey, sorry to use that word, with cunning as well, because cunning obviously has the meaning of being skillful and crafty, sometimes a bit sly with it. But because all of these were seen as being quite clever and positive, in US slang, to be cunning was to be quaintly interesting or to be pretty and attractive, to be quite cute. And you find it also morphed into canny as well. That's all from the same root. So yeah, language often does this. But as I say, if you think about the sort of traditional meaning of acute, you would never put it together with acute, I think. But that is definitely its derivation.
And that word again, aphesis, for when there's a missing bit of the aphesis.
Yes, it's when a short unaccented vowel sort of drops off the beginning of a word.
Ah, so it wouldn't be the same as, for example, until. People sometimes say till, meaning until.
Oh,
till
yeah.
Till we meet again, until we meet again.
What, yes. Is that, that's more different? Of an abbreviation, really.
Fine.
Yes, it's more to do with very short vowels.
Very good. And yeah. I learned something interesting the other day. I've been misspelling a violoncello all my life. I knew that cello, I thought the cello was short for violoncello. It turns out it's short for violoncello. So it's V-I-O-L-O-N. C-H-C-E-L-L-O. Okay. But that, again, is an abbreviation, not an aphesis.
No, that's a diminutive, isn't it, of violone, the little violone, violoncello, yes.
Violoncello.
Lovely. I wish I could speak Italian.
I wish you. You make it sound as if it's going to be a lovely pasta dish we're going to have tonight. Can we meet
it?
Together?
Let's
have a little violoncello. Violoncello with a little, or maybe a wine, a lovely, slightly green wine on a sun-kissed hill in Lombardy.
Do you not miss that? That's a conversation for another day. You miss the
whole
etiquette.
I miss the idea, but I don't miss the reality of it.
No.
And I don't mind never falling asleep in front of the television.
No, I'm with you on that one.
If people have got letters they want to send, queries they'd like answered, the address is simply purple@somethingelse.com. So do please be in touch with us. Susie, do we know how many words there are in the world? You come up with a trio, three new words every week. Is it a bottomless pit? How many words in the English language are there overall, do you think?
Oh, it's an impossible question, really, because I think we've talked about this before, because how do you sort of describe a word? So if you took, for example, run, do you include runs, ran, running? Yeah. So it is a bottomless pit from that point of view. But if you look at a sort of dictionaries, you will find usually about 500,000 head words, if you like. So that's kind of where, but you know, a lot of those would be obsolete. And it says that the second edition of the 20-volume OED contains full entries for just over 171,000. But honestly, there are far more than that. I mean, you know, you might have 1 million distinct words if you do count all of those inflections and things.
Good. 1 million words, of which you seem to know every single
none.
One. And no. You know all of them.
I know some of them. I don't know all of them.
You know a million words.
I absolutely don't. I knew I'd honestly learn a different word every single day.
Well, you're going to teach us three words now, and let's see if we can remember them in a week's time.
Okay.
What are the three words?
I think they're just sort of quite, I don't know if they're quite useful, but they're just quite quaint. So the first one is, particularly in hot weather, if you find yourself changing your shirt quite often and just sort of, you want to just say, look, do you know what? I've just run out of shirts. You can call yourself lack linen. I'm a bit lack linen. Shakespeare used it. Wanting shirt, lack linen. I just quite like that one. It's just a bit silly. Also, you will have heard of a rake hell. So a rake hell is somebody who's so dissolute that they would literally sort of rake the floor of hell for whatever they could get. And I just discovered that there's an adjective for someone who is a bit wild, hence the town red, which is rake helly. I just like the idea of being rake helly.
Is that they're pretty dissolute, are they?
Very dissolute. Yes.
Very dissolute.
Very dissolute indeed.
In excess of the violoncello, and you end up rake helly.
Okay. Rake helly. The third one is sluggardize. So a sluggard is somebody who is
lazy,
exactly. But to sluggardize is rarer, and that's a verb meaning to make lazy. So I just like the idea of saying, you know, too much scrolling through Instagram can sluggardize you no end. Because it does. It just induces that kind of torpor, doesn't it? Where you just literally can't be bothered to do anything. So I quite like that word.
I don't want to get into a sluggardizing state.
No.
But no, that's why I've got to avoid the life of a rake hell.
A rake hell.
Because you lose your shirt that way and
yes.
You end up lack linen.
Very good.
I love sluggardize. Well, we've been talking about cats, and I've already recommended one poem by T.S. Eliot, Gus the Theatre Cat, too long to read here. But I have got another one. My favourite cat poem, I think this is. It's a lovely poem by Eleanor Fargen, who lived from the 1880s to the 1960s and wrote some wonderful children's stories and some beautiful poetry, of which this is perhaps my favourite. It's called Cats Sleep Anywhere. Cats sleep anywhere. Any table, any chair. Top of piano, window ledge, in the middle, on the edge, open drawer, empty shoe, anybody's lap will do. Fitted in a cardboard box, in the cupboard with your frocks, anywhere. They don't care. Cats sleep anywhere.
So they do, including on my head.
They do, don't they? They're marvellous.
We
would
love
we
Nala.
Without...
We love Bo.
We do.
Yes. We just love the cats.
And we love the Purple People so much that for the summer, we've got this amazing 20% off offer on our merchandise. All the stock in our online store. You just go to the link in the episode description, and we've got T-shirts, mugs, totes available while stocks last.
Absolutely. And thank you for listening to the show. And if you do love it, please keep following us. Please recommend us to your friends. And if you would like to follow us on our new social media channels, you can find us on @somethingrhymes on Twitter and Facebook, or @somethingrhymeswith on Instagram. And do consider joining the Purple Plus Club if you would like, for some bonus episodes on words and language. Thank you for listening. Something Rhymes with Purple is a Something Else production, produced by Lawrence Bassett and Harriet Wells, with additional production from Chris Skinner, Jen Mystery, Jay Beale, Josh, and...
Oh, the sluggardizer himself.
Oh, my goodness. It's Gully.